Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hi, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. My name's Daniel, and today I'm really excited to be joined by Jacob Myers, who is from Appalachia in North Carolina. I first met Jacob out in the Yukon in the winter earlier this year, and we're going to have a chat about the event he was participating in a bit later. But yeah, welcome to the podcast, Jacob.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
Good to see you from 4,000 miles away.
Yeah, it's a bit far away, isn't it? But yeah, it's great to have you, and we're going to have an interesting chat about some of your adventures and then your upcoming one that I believe you had quite an exciting email about an hour ago.
Yeah. Should I say what the email was, or should we get into that later?
Yeah, go on then, tell us.
Yeah. So I've been training for the past 2.5 years to get a sort of like polar resume put together. I'm making an attempt at being the youngest person in human history to ski completely alone and completely unsupported to the geographic South Pole. That'll be from the edge of the Antarctic continent. It's a 700-mile journey. And I just got in the email an hour ago right now that's finally been approved.
Yeah, because there's a fair few hoops, I guess, from a safety perspective and a logistics perspective to jump through and make sure you've got the skills and things.
Yeah, you don't want a bunch of people just running around on the ice not knowing what they're doing.
Yeah, no, it's not ideal. So yeah, that's a teaser of what we're going to talk about shortly. But let's just sort of hold that, keep people sort of on the edge, and just have a chat about where we first met in the Yukon. So you were, I guess, as part of the training for the South Pole and part of that process, you were participating in the Montane Arctic Ultra event.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. The 300-mile category.
Yeah, and I guess what sort of attracted you to that race? How did you kind of find out about it, and what was sort of the motivation behind it?
I've been an ultra runner for 3 years now. I've been in the outdoor space a lot longer than that. But what brought me to that race specifically was when one of my sort of heroes in the field, Henry Worsley, was training for his big Antarctic expedition back when, he ran this race as a part of his qualifying status. And so in my head, I just thought it would be so cool to run this race in honor of Henry, considering the people that he's trained and brought into the polar space are my mentors now. So he was sort of like he's my grandfather in this tutelage of polar travel.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And how was the race? How did you find it? I mean, working on it was awesome. It was a great environment to be in. But I guess it came with its challenges as well.
Yeah. I mean, we were pretty blessed as far as temperatures go. I don't know if it was the mildest year temperature-wise, but it was, you know... It certainly wasn't down in the minus 30s like other races have been for the majority of the time. It made the snow a little bit soft. You kind of sunk through, so you moved quite a bit slow, especially on all the lake traverses. But the race itself was phenomenal. We saw the Northern Lights 3 or 4 times, you know, night after night. They would just sort of pop up, and you'd walk in that illuminated haze, and every other racer that you run into wants to see you finish that race. They want to see you cross the finish line so badly. So everyone's talking kit and leaning on each other for support. And it's 15 hours of darkness. So we're buddy-buddying up and trying to stay together as often as we can to keep everyone positive and moving forward. And it was phenomenal.
Yeah, I know. That's certainly, that was going to be sort of one of the things I was going to ask you about. That's a lot. It's a long time to potentially be alone with your thoughts and just a head torch in the night.
Yeah. My isolation was typically, I broke the race into 3 shifts. There's morning shift, day shift, and night. So every morning from about 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, till the sun came up, which the sun comes up just shy of 10 o'clock. Mm. So that's almost a full work day that I was completely alone marching with my headlamp. But by the time daytime came around, you'd hit an aid station and you'd meet racers and we'd spend the day together. We'd get a resupply. We would run into the medics and all the, you know, we'd see you and we'd see Tony.
I'd have a lift at your feet. Yeah.
I got to gross you out with all my, well, I guess they weren't frostbitten, but all of my cold blisters.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that thing that you said a second ago about the kind of the camaraderie and that sense of community, it was really strong, wasn't it? I think there were some super interesting people on that race.
I met 4 different volunteers who were previously competitors in that race.
Mm.
I inevitably had to pull out of the race. And when I did pull out and I got to the aid station following where I had pulled out, I was greeted by a mob of people just giving me hugs and congratulating me on, you know, how phenomenal the effort was and all those sorts of things. It's what you find in the ultra endurance communities. Everyone wants to bring the best out in each other.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's the really nice thing about it, isn't it? And certainly... Yeah, there were people sort of cheering each other on because there were some people who'd kind of been battling with the race a few times over various distances. I think there was a lot of success stories this year, I think, and maybe in part that was maybe because the conditions were a bit better, but it was still in my opinion, a ridiculous undertaking. I'm full of admiration for all of the people who sort of were doing the event. And I believe it finished with a massive cinnamon bun, sort of the size of your head.
I turned 25 during the race. And so the second day of the race was my birthday. And I was greeted, with a cinnamon bud that was bigger than my head. And it had a little sparkler in it. So I was probably 30 yards out and they lit this thing and I could see it spewing fireworks into the air and they were singing happy birthday at like whatever it was. Still dark out, no sunlight, standing outside and it's -14°F, whatever that is in Celsius.
Yeah, I can't do the maths on that off the top of my head, but yeah, we'll get back to you on that one. But I guess what did you take from that race towards your preparation and I guess some of the things you maybe learned about yourself during it?
I mean, the effect of caloric intake on your cognitive ability is huge. It's something that I've known forever in theory. And I mean, we certainly know that like what you put in your body regulates how you function, but for me, I was really interested to see how the deeper I got in the caloric hole, because I wasn't eating very appropriately during the race. My actual ability to think and process, make plans and execute them was really, really impacted. I distinctly remember night 3, I keep my sleeping bag inside my bivy on top of a foam mat, and between them is an inflatable mat. So I blew up the inflatable. And I put it inside the bivy and I put the inflatable on top of my sleeping bag. So I crawled in and I tried to pull my bag up and I was like, oh, I'm laying on top of my sleeping bag. So I got out and I took the sleeping pad out, flipped the bivy, put the sleeping pad back in. And when I crawled in, I realized I had done the same exact thing a second time.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Knowing that I had made the mistake, I crawled out into the middle of the night, took it out, and I put it exactly back where I had put it the first time. And I'm kneeling with my headlamp facing it, and I'm looking at my bivy, and I'm having trouble processing what I'm doing wrong.
Huh.
Sleep depth, caloric depravity, all those things.
I was gonna say maybe the whole sleep thing was an issue for quite a lot of people, and I guess it's. Yeah, it's well known on sort of ultra events, sleep is one of the main challenges, particularly if you are having to bivy. How did you sort of manage that?
I mean, we just navigated it. I think I'm lucky enough that I have enough cold weather experience where if I need to take a couple extra minutes in the cold to address some silliness like that, I'm comfortable doing that. I know that my gear is properly rated and I know that I can handle being in the cold. So if I have to set up my sleeping system twice, then I have to set up my sleeping system twice. The big thing was that I caught back up on my sleep, but I never really managed to pull myself out of the caloric hole. I think that's what ultimately led to me having to pull out of the race.
Yeah, no, that's and that was a shame for sure. But I guess it's something that you'll take on board in terms of preparation and meal planning and stuff for your next adventure, which will come to shortly. But just before you came to visit me in Wales, I know you'd also been up in Norway, just sort of honing your winter skills with the Shackleton team. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that experience.
They're phenomenal. I'm so blessed to be a part of that crew. Lou Rudd and Wendy Searle are sort of the heads of the expedition department. So Lou has skied to the South Pole 5 times now. Wendy skied to the South Pole once. She did it all on her own. It's just a great team. And what they did was they gave me enough of a training foundation last year for me to go out this season into Norway. And I did a 20-day solo expedition. So I packed my polk, or that's what we call our sleds in the polar community. I packed my polk and I skied out onto this glacier and spent 20 days in isolation, just sleeping in the cold and navigating map and compass, trying to get accustomed to dealing with whiteout conditions, setting up my tent on my own, obviously doing a much better job of balancing my caloric intake, eating about 6,000 calories a day.
That's a fair amount. And that's all with ration packs, is it?
Ration packs and grazing bags. So nuts, dried chocolate, dried fruit, all that sorts of thing. That was good. It went very, very well. And I came off that solo expedition and started guiding with the Shackleton team on the glacier. So the current sort of conversation is in what capacity they should bring me on to join them next season as we expand outside of Norway into Iceland and Greenland, the Yukon Arctic, Yellowstone, maybe things like that.
That sounds super cool. Let's now move on to sort of your South Pole project. So I know you said, you know, been planning and training for that for a year, and I guess when did it kind of come into your head that, you know, you wanted to sort of ski to the South Pole?
When I first read Lou's book, I read the majority of it atop a mountain in Montana, and you know, that's sort of a lab beaker for inspiration. You're reading this incredible story of adventure, and then I'm watching the sunrise from 11,000 feet in front of me. I can see Yellowstone in the distance, and there was something in that pursuit of challenge, the way that I think doing hard things shapes our character and the way that it benefits our lives. It was a culmination of all that. And I said, I'm going to do this one day. And then it went from being something I'll do one day to a really serious conversation on a porch with a friend of mine where I said, if I really commit to this, I think I could be the youngest to ever do it. And so I signed up to be a client on the Shackleton Challenges last year.
Oh, yeah.
And I went out for a week as a client with them. And at the very end of that expedition experience, Wendy Searle, who is their logistics coordinator and their second-in-command guide, she approached me and she said, if you have any actual desire to do this, she said, I will volunteer to be your expedition manager and we're going to make sure this happens, but I need you to commit.
No pressure then.
No pressure. Standing in the snow by the train station, you know, shaking hands with these two polar legends. And she kind of looked me in the eye and she said, are you going to keep talking about it? Or are you going to actually do something about it?
Yeah. She gave you that nudge, I guess. Yeah. That's amazing. And just tell people listening again just how far that's going to be in terms of the distance and I guess the time that you think it's going to take as well.
Yeah, so the numbers involved in the project, South Pole, many people don't know, is over 9,000 feet in elevation. So, you know, over 3,000 meters in elevation. It's actually quite high. It's a 720 nautical mile journey. It'll take probably 50 some odd days with temps down to or floating around minus 40 in the interior, which is where Celsius and Fahrenheit meet. So that's an easy conversion for me.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So minus 40 temps. And I'll leave from the edge of the continent. That's the mainland, terra firma. That's not the ice sheets in the ocean. Leave from the edge of the mainland. The plane will take off and wave me goodbye. And then I have 700 some odd miles of skiing every single day, dragging everything I need to survive until I see another human being at the geographic South Pole.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I guess I know it's kind of a solo attempt and it is completely unsupported, you said?
Yes.
Yeah. I guess, how does that make you feel in terms of, you know, it's a long distance. It's a long time. How do you reckon you're going to kind of manage that? I guess it'll be building on some of the things you've done already as well.
The challenges are evident, right? They're going to be caloric deprivation, isolation, and lengthy amounts of time in the cold. Sort of the three big factors, right? I mean, weather, you know, you could say is the fourth, but you know,
that's sure, yeah. Cold. Yeah, yeah.
And so we've worked to address all of these. I've been really dialing in my food kit. The food that I eat on expeditions is different than the food that I eat when I'm, you know, running that race in the Arctic. But I have my food dialed in now. And the question was, well, how I respond in isolation. Well, I went and spent 20 days in isolation. And yeah. I felt really good because every single day I woke up and I had a mission to attend to, a certain amount of time I wanted to be on my skis or a place that I wanted to get to. So that was fine too. And yeah, I think the challenges that will test me the most are probably the ones that I haven't yet anticipated. They'll be situational, right? Happenstance type things that come about in the field that you can't really plan for, but you have to be prepared to navigate by staying very calm and addressing the situations as they come.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? You can't prepare for absolutely everything, but I guess, yeah, if you've got that, I guess that self-awareness and sort of that ability to almost just sort of zoom out, you know, take things as they come. That's half the challenge. And I guess in terms of the kind of kit you're taking with you, so it'd be interesting just to sort of touch on that, because obviously, yeah, you're going to be pulling your pod, but it's a balance, I guess, between weight, but also those essential items as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm really grateful that I grew up in a day and age where we have the engineering capabilities of making things very light but still robust. Which doesn't mean the Polk will be absolutely light. You know, it'll be 60, 70 kg. But yeah, I mean the tents are Hilleberg's, so that's top of the grade or top of the line, expedition grade tent. And I've gone in and I've cut all the metal tabs off of all the zippers and replaced every single one of them with string pulleys. Done the same thing on my expedition jackets, cut tags and lips off pockets, and even our food, the dehydrated field rations, if you keep them as they are, they're a backpacking style rehydrated meal. Once you eat it, you're left with this big piece of packaging because it's thermal lined and all that.
Yeah.
So we don't even take that. I'll be rationing that out into freezer bags and I'll keep a little pot on me and I'll rehydrate all my meals in the same pot. So we're going to some pretty extreme lengths just to keep weight down. I'll have one, you know, one change of clothes for the entire journey, two pairs of working socks, one pair of sleeping socks,
yeah.
Very few luxuries. I'm not bringing coffee. I'm not bringing alcohol.
Oh, no coffee.
Did I tell you I accidentally quit caffeine in my 20-day journey?
Oh, okay. But if you accidentally did it and it was all okay, I guess that's going to be okay.
I had a friend pick me up my instant coffee, and they got the decaf, and I didn't realize until day 15 of my solo expedition that it was decaf, because I was just drinking it every day and it wasn't a big deal. And I was thinking, like, I wonder what the caffeine content of this is. It said caffeine free. I was like, oh, I haven't had a drop of caffeine in 2 weeks.
There you go. And are you going to take, I know you said no luxuries, but is there going to be something that you're going to have in terms of your food or something like that? You know, if you are having a particularly difficult or a low time that you can rely on, or is the weight's too important to bring that?
I really like hot chocolate in the evenings. I'd definitely bring some hot chocolate, which is great because there's not a ton, but there's caloric value to that, certainly more so than coffee. My big luxury is music, which I'm very thankful that it is, because headphones don't weigh a whole lot.
Yeah, that's true. How are you going to keep the batteries going and keep them charged and stuff?
That time of year, the Antarctic summer, it's 24 hours of daylight.
I won't see
the sunset for 60, 70 days. I won't see the sunset.
Mm.
And so you can put the panel on top of the polk on days with fair weather, and on days where the weather's a little more aggressive. When you get in the tent at the end of the day, the tent has an inner and an outer liner. And so you can hang the panel between the inner and outer, and there's still enough solar radiation to charge that solar panel through the tent wall.
Uh-huh. Every day's a school day.
Yeah.
I'll bear that in mind if I ever find myself in the Antarctic. Oh, no, that's fantastic. And I guess in terms of you're going to take a pretty comprehensive medical kit as well, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the big things are going to be overuse injuries. So we'll need kinesthetic tape to address those sorts of things, and it's bandages and splints in case I fall on any of the sastrugi and break or bruise or sprain anything. Mm-hmm. Treatments for cold weather related injuries like frostbite.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's gonna be interesting for sure. And then once you get to the South Pole, I know you're planning on going to, I think it's Australia, is that right?
Yeah.
Work on a project to kind of carbon offset the kind of the cost of the trip.
Yeah, there's two charitable wings to this project. There's the social front. I come from Appalachia, and in the States, Appalachia is disproportionately affected by the opioid epidemic. And so a lot of programs in outdoor community spaces exist, but not a lot of people are aware of them, especially not young people who I think could most benefit from plugging into outdoor spaces. So I'm bringing the project, whether we succeed or fail, and I'm going to be presenting about this, 3-year-long experience of training and executing this expedition in the pole. While I'm doing that speaking tour, I'll be handing out information to all the students about local mountain bike clubs, angling societies, bird watching groups, trail crews, whatever. I believe very deeply in the healing powers of outdoor spaces. And I believe very deeply that if we surround ourselves with a healthy sense of community, we're far less likely to fall into those sort of the holes that lead Appalachians to getting on drugs.
Yeah, no, I think, the value of sort of those outdoor experiences and communities definitely can't be understated for sure, yeah.
To your point, the planting project's cool. So Climate Force 360 is an official, it's our eco partner. It's the youngest to pole project's eco partner. And they're reforesting this massive rainforest over in Queensland, Australia. So I'm estimating my total carbon expenditure that went into putting this whole project together. And I'll be joining Barney Swan and his whole team over there, where I'll personally plant enough trees to offset that carbon. So I'll join them for a full planting season, or probably not a full planting season, but for a month or two, and get my hands dirty and try and give back what I've taken from these places in pursuit of this.
Yeah, that's really good. It's very inspiring, the amount of programs that you're getting involved. And if people want to find out more about your project, because I'm conscious we're starting to run out of time with that Zoom timer at the top. What can people do to find out a bit more or support you or get involved?
I talk about the project almost every day on my Instagram, which is Youngest to Pole Project. But we're going live next week with a donation link, and there's a lot of information about the project on my website, which is valhallahikes.com.
I was going to ask you the origins of the name for your website as well.
When you hike the Appalachian Trail or any of the long distance American trails, it's sort of ingrained in American hiking culture that you receive a trail name or nickname to go by. And the trail name that I had received back when I attempted the Appalachian Trail in 2020 was Valhalla. And that mostly has to do with my fascination of Viking lore and how many of my friends are in serving in the military, because there's a big Viking war honor kind of tie-in with the military thing. And so that I was Valhalla on the trail. And then when I realized that there was this sort of identity that I had created in pursuit of outdoor spaces, I reduced it to Val. And then almost everyone in the outdoor community sort of knows me as Val.
That's really cool. I don't know if that's is that an American thing, the trail names? I feel like it should become a thing in the UK as well. There aren't any long ones, not as long as over there, though, I guess.
You get some really fun ones. There's great names. We had a buddy take a dive off one of the platforms that we were sleeping on when he got up in the night to go pee. He thought it was close to the ground and it was far. And so we stepped off and face planted. And then for like 3 months, we were calling him Free Fall.
Very good. Yeah, that's the thing with nicknames. They have a bad habit of following you around, don't they? Well, I'm just conscious we're coming towards the end, but it's been great to have you on the podcast, Jacob. And I will, I should call you Val. And I will, I'll put the links to your website and your Instagram as well in the description for this episode. Thanks once again, and the best of luck with your adventures.
So great to see you. Thank you for bringing me on.
Thanks for coming.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.